You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. There's a prison task force in the state's future. That's right, there is another one. We turn now to our Dakota political junkies to discuss the latest news from the governor's office. Michael Card is a political scientist and professor emeritus at the University of South Dakota. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. He's an inductee into the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. They join me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. All right, we're going to talk about the prison. Hopefully people aren't tired about talking about the prison, because this week Governor Larry Roden has released names for the next step. John, tell us a little bit about what happens next. We've been through the special session. We have a decision to build. Now what?
Well, this is the second of two task force. Governor Roden had a task force about should we build a new prison, where should it be, how much should we spend, and those things. That appeared to be a pretty successful task force. But he and others realized that building bars and walls and hiring guards is not enough to have a successful corrections system. And I've been pretty vocal about this, at least, or maybe I guess, is writing in a newspaper vocal?
Yeah, it is.
So I've written a number of editorials on trying to adopt successful methods for returning people to society. And that's even too simplistic. There's all sorts of people out there. They have all sorts of backgrounds, how they got here into the prison and so forth. So they really do need individualized care to be able to return them. But the power of that, Lori, is amazing. If you, 1,500 prisoners, if you were able to increase the number who were successfully returned by 100 or 200, it's remarkable. Huge cost savings for the state, huge impact in the towns that they live in as being employees or family people or buy houses or pay taxes or whatever they do. The power of returning people back is very large. And remember that almost all the people who are sent to the state penitentiary do return to society. There are very few who die in prison. So let's do our best there. And doing our best, and I think the task force has been charged with that. Let's do our best with this. However, I think it's incumbent on us to try to find where these things have been successful elsewhere and copy them. And I tried to look up what are the best prisons in the world that would return people to society successfully, and they were all over the globe. There were a surprising number in Scandinavia, two in Norway, one in Sweden, but Australia, Singapore, some in the United States. But let's really expand our palette here and look elsewhere for successful models. They're not going to be perfect. I mean, naturally, the 30 people who are on this, or 29 or whatever it is, are all from South Dakota, and that's fine. Right. But I'd love to see a vision of more global to try to find this. And there are a lot of prisons there's one in Norway that has – it's like an island. And if we think of an island prison, we think of Alcatraz, right? And that's right. Al Capone and so forth. But this one's very successful. It has farms. It has, you know, people living together, working together, very successful, and then return people. And in South Dakota, where you have, you know, some of the people are here for nonviolent kinds of offenses. They're in the state penitentiary, probably learning violence to a degree to survive there. Let's successfully return those folks, and let's use great examples and not have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, this is the Correctional Rehabilitation Task Force. Mike Card, what stands out to you from the people who are on the task force, or what the task might be ahead?
Well, I think the task ahead is to look to see what has been successful. I mean, John is right on target with that. This the task force model that the Dugard administration used, that was used to eventually get the prison over the barriers to getting it done, were basically to call people together, let's argue out what we want out of this. We find out who the enemies are and what they want. We see if we can compromise. And then we look at what's the best plan to go forward. And I suspect that's the same sort of model that will be used here. We don't see people who have, you know, other than former Secretary Tim Ryche, who at least by quick examination has been involved in corrections and rehabilitation, although there are...
Deputy Secretary Brent Fluke,
yeah,
Department
okay.
of Corrections, will be second one. Yeah.
Okay, so there are some, but we just have to now hope that they bring people in who are used to returning people to society. Yeah. We need to look at what our records are. Have there been successful reintroductions to society here? What worked? Were there personality characteristics? Were there programming opportunities available for them? You know, and we've had some that have been fairly successful with prison industries, but again, not all the jobs that we can do in prison industries actually prepare people. Roden was certainly emphasizing right after the passage of the bill that, you know, we just need to move to this next step. We need to get people back to society.
John,
and if we think about what prisons were designed to do was to get people to contemplate what they did. You know, at least the prisons in the United States had a Quaker origin. You know, certainly there are other prison models that let's lock them up in the Tower of London, and when we don't want to feed them anymore, we can execute them. But that's not what we're, I hope, that's not what we're trying to do, is these people will be released to society. How can they be truly contributing members?
The tension, and you mentioned the Quaker model, which, of course, the tension of isolation and contemplation, which also turned into more of a solitary confinement.
Yep.
And so that is an imperfect model for sure. All of our models are somewhat imperfect.
Right.
But the current tension often seems to be punishment versus rehab. Like, how are you, making sure that the public feels these people are being punished for a crime, but that also when they come back into society, as most of them do, they are ready to come back with something that has helped them with a leg up. John, how are some of the ways to be thinking about that tension? Because that also becomes somewhat of a political football.
It does. That's an accurate statement. For a lot of people, remembering that the threat of jail or prison is, to many people, is a deterrent from crime. Like, I'll get in trouble and I'll go to jail for this. And so there is an element of that. And so I don't want to dismiss the element of locking people up temporarily for that. But I think that much more than we've ever thought before, it's not a one-size-fit-all to one. To your point, there's all sorts of people there with all sorts of backgrounds. It's almost like in the schools where they do these IEPs, the individual education mm-hmm. programs. Is that what those yep. stands for? And mm-hmm. so here's what's going to be best for this person. And I know if you have 1,500 people and you're, especially if you're understaffed, it's almost impossible to do that. So the key element here, too, is the task force. Best wishes to everyone, because they're going to have to use a lot more money contributing to this than we probably have in the past. Remember,
right.
they said, well, the prison is going to have a lot more square feet for programming. Well, that's terrific. I'm all for square feet. But it's going to be, whether it's counselors or tradespeople, and there is, you know, someone from Southeast Tech on there, mm-hmm. You know, maybe can identify or partner with the system and use instructors. And there is some of that going on already. But it's a big issue. It's hard. It may be expensive, but the benefits are extraordinary of being successful in this. You know, there's just one more quick one. Our church has a program where once a year they go have ministry at the prison.
Sure.
And one time recently it was like a going away ceremony for one of the prisoners who was going to be released. And it was a happy moment and so forth. But as they described, you know, it's literally like, here's a few bucks, push you out the door, best wishes to you. It's like, what? I mean, I know halfway houses sound trite and maybe from Shawshank Redemption or something, but we should have some of these things that get, you know, let's get housing, let's get food, let's get support, let's get a job. It seems like there's so much potential there.
Right. I'm curious, too, what the role is of accountability and facing past failures is in a task force like this, to look at the data for how rehabilitation has gone and to say, okay, you wanted to do some house cleaning here. The house has been quote unquote cleaned and you've moved some people out, but at what point is there accountability for how things were done and how you measure going forward? This is a big job.
That might be outside the purview.
That might be outside the purview of this particular committee, but that is ongoing work.
Well, I mean, for me, this is very much like parenting. These are individuals who have committed a crime against the society. Do we think that they are bad people, or have they done a bad thing? Because if we treat them as a bad person, then we want to lock them up and keep them away from society. There are people like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect that's not everyone. That at some point we need to be like our own children, is to have a conversation. What did you do? Why was it wrong? What are you going to do differently? How are you going to keep from repeating this?
What do you need?
Yeah.
What happened to you?
Right.
What do you need to be successful?
And a lot of people have practiced bad habits. You know, if they had a rough childhood or something, they may have been doing bad things from a very young age. So we have to undo. If you do that for 15 years before you're put into prison, you've got a lot of undoing to do. You know, it's not like, hey, be good from now on. Or, you know, it's not a quick process. And again, back to this IEP concept, is that people who have, you know, terrible situations growing up, bad examples, and no role models and so forth, they will need more assistance than someone who was at a party and something bad happened and they got swept up in something and they're not inherently as criminal.
And that, you know, staffing, that this rehabilitation conversation, again, is probably, staffing is probably outside the purview of it. But if you are a correctional officer, you want to work at a place where you are helping people. You're keeping the community safe, but you are also dealing in a safe environment so you can go home to your family and you'd like to feel like you did some good.
But I think it is a purview of this kind of thing, is the therapy and the but if it's understaffed, it's the same thing that happens down at Yankton, where you don't have as many successful outcomes if you're just trying to I'm just trying to get through today alive. So it will take money, it will take, but the power of what can happen is extraordinary.
So let's talk about Lieutenant Governor Venhuizen, because he is chairing this task force as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And had that challenge of getting the approval and taking Governor Larry Roden's initiative forward, getting people back to peer, getting them to a vote. You know, this is there's a governor's race going on. So some politics intruded on that, but the project moved forward. What do we know about Lieutenant Governor Venhuizen and his ability to do that on behalf of the governor's office? Looking pretty good that he got the first one over the finish line, and now he is here handing him the baton again.
I think it's exactly why he handed him the baton because, and Larry, I'll try to say this as nicely as I can, I think Larry recognizes that Tony is better at that than he is. And a job as governor, you don't do everything yourself. You don't chair every committee. You don't join every task force. You have to delegate. And so I think he delegates to someone that's just shown recent success in this. And so I would guess that this one's a little bit bigger, has more people in it.
Yeah.
Might be, I don't know if it's more or less controversial than the first one. But there's, and I don't know how many meetings, you know, here it is October. And if we, of course, we got 3 years or whatever before we're going to build this thing.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, could some of the recommendations of this stuff be implemented as low-hanging fruit now that you could harvest and be successful?
Is he a normal lieutenant governor? Historically, is this what lieutenant governors do, or are we seeing a new sort of era of your lieutenant governor?
Well, I think beginning, you know, in my memory, it's beginning with George Mikkelsen, in the sense that now we have a lieutenant governor who has more day-to-day duties and responsibilities. Because as I recall, and this may not be exactly correct, is the appointment of Walter Dale Miller, who had other responsibilities, primarily in the field of agriculture, and to supervise that portion of the government that Governor Mikkelsen just didn't have. So I think we've seen more full-time governors over the past three decades than we did in probably the previous 10. But again, we can also think back before 1974, our lieutenant governors were basically there, just there, where, you know, they didn't have very many responsibilities. It was to We needed somebody to be governor should the unthinkable happen and the governor passes away.
And president of the Senate.
And president of the Senate, which is a, you know, at least a three-month, four-month job. But it was also a two-year term, so you did that once.
In a
two-year term, and maybe twice if with re-election.
Mayor Paul Ten Haken is on this task force as well, and he's been vocal about, hey, we're going to build this here in Sioux Falls when many other communities didn't want it or fought against it. We're going to need some support from the state. But also, he's been pretty public about telling the people of Sioux Falls to show up and mentor, to, you know, help people, you know, to hire, you know, people who are coming out. That seems like an opportunity for me as well, John. What do you think about the mayor of a city, especially one like Paul Ten Haken, coming out and saying, this is what we need to do as a city to support the people behind bars and their families?
Agreed. In addition, I think you'll see that the cooperation with law enforcement agencies in Sioux Falls, whether it's county, Minnehaha County Sheriff's Department or City of Sioux Falls Police, because there is so much coordination that, and at least in my casual, distant observation, it seems like those law enforcement agencies are cooperating a little bit better with each other, communicating better. But yes, you know, people that are arrested by Sioux Falls City Police are going to end up in the penitentiary. So if you're concerned about at all the lifespan of this, from the crime all the way to the successful reentry, there's a lot of people involved. And so I think having Mayor Ten Haken in that is a very good idea. And I think he'll be an active member. But to your point, Lori, about encouraging citizens of Sioux Falls to participate in this in some way, maybe it's just vocal support. Maybe it's telling your employer, yeah, maybe you could help in this some way too. I mean, there's a lot of ways that citizens can contribute. Yeah.
You're a prison town, Sioux Falls. You're a prison town. Yeah. You always have been.
In 1992, right after I came back from Ohio into South Dakota, I worked for Steve Feimer in the Government Research Bureau. And we had a project supported by the Department of Corrections, and our job was to find out how inmates who were released got jobs. Mm-hmm. And it really came down to I lied on my application because they weren't employable, weren't able to be employed if they showed that they had a prison record or a criminal record. And they knew that they would be fired as soon as that came out. That's, you know, that's what it is. And so if we don't change and work towards changing the mindset that these people need to return to society in a constructive manner, we will be back at the point where they can't get a job unless they lie, and they may lie about a number of other things.
Yeah. State's attorney from Minnehaha County. Minnehaha County Jail Warden is here, Pennington County Sheriff on the list, and a whole lot of lawmakers. I was going to say there's not really anybody from, like, the business community, but that's not true, especially when you look at the lawmakers.
Right. The legislators.
You know, the legislators are often, you know, representing different areas of business as well. All right. So it's a conversation that maybe is that we haven't had because our prison is gothic and rotting. And all
those are the nicest things that anyone's ever said about that. Gothic and rotting.
Who is Larry Roden? Governor Roden, I think those are his words. I'm paraphrasing.
When my came back married and my poor wife was a runner, and she said, "What is that beautiful building up on the hill?" "That's the penitentiary."
Yeah.
"Oh, wished I hadn't done that."
Well, I can tell this. I can one too that our daughter Carolyn, she was an infant and went in the back seat and drove past that, and she said to us, "All of a sudden, I have a bad feeling."
Oh.
Didn't know what it was, but there was. Sometimes young children are more aware of something, but she said, "I have a bad feeling now."
Yeah.
Didn't know what it was.
We visited. You know, I had a family member who was incarcerated, and I remember coming to town and sitting in the visitor room and just being terrified the entire time I was in there. And it also was painted like a Burger King or a McDonald's, like this orange, yellow, brown kind of 1970s color palette, which I found really disconcerting because I liked Burger King and McDonald's and I didn't like that place.
No toys there, no Burger King toys that you got.
So children visit I guess, is the point that I'm making. This is a long time ago, but I'm assuming that children still visit family members there, and you have to have a sense of, you know, what kind of environment can children go into to do a family visitation, which also matters. Let's talk about a couple of things before we let you go, and one is this, listeners are going to hear two Democratic candidates, Nikki Gronley and Billy Mawinney, who are both running as Democrats in South Dakota for the U.S. House seat that Dusty Johnson will vacate. And as they go around, both, you know, all of them, Julian Baudouin came on as well. He's running for Mike Rounds' seat in U.S. Senate. I heard the same thing from all three of them, which is I'm really doing a lot of listening. I'm on the gravel road tour, or I'm in the rural communities, or I'm going out here and there at town halls, and I'm hearing what people have to say. And Democrats are going to have a tough time getting votes in South Dakota. It might even be impossible, Mike Card, historically speaking. No, it's not impossible. It's a big uphill battle, but it seems to me that these candidates have a role right now, even if the role isn't sweeping victory, and they're beginning with listening, and that seems like a good start.
I think it's absolutely the start that I wish every candidate would engage in, is doing more listening than they do telling.
Yeah.
And because they are representatives of the people, and to some extent their representation is what they think is best for the people. And so we speak of those who are delegates, and that is they do exactly as the people want, and those who may be a little more entrepreneurial, which is looking and thinking about what would be the best thing for society, even though some of the people are really going to be disaffected by it. So a listening campaign and finding out what the people want has to be part of the overall agenda of the Democratic Party. That's how democracy works, is if you aren't keeping up with what the people actually want, then we're moving towards a different form of our government. You know, it's if we think about it, our founders wanted a republic. And the reason they wanted a republic, or their mechanism for wanting a republic, was actually to have a conflict in between the different branches of government. And that was their way of staving off an authoritarian rule. So if we're listening to the people, we're going to be much less likely to be authoritarian and I will do what I want. And I'm not saying that's what we have at the state level right now. But I think it's wise to do a more listening first, and a real listening, as opposed to I've got solutions for you.
Right. And I would argue, too, that it's, and I'm quite sure the Republicans are saying that they're going on listening tours as well. I'm not implying that they're not. We just happened to talk to two Democrats this week. But, John, the other factor in this is that social media is not listening. So if you're creating your, you know, your social media presence, that would not be necessarily a moment of listening. Do you see what I'm getting at there? What's the difference between, you know, having social media engagement and sitting around someone's kitchen table is what I'm getting at.
Well, there's a size and time element that how can you visit 400,000 households in
right.
a campaign?
Right.
And that's hard to do that. So you do need, as best you can, group those together. But I think you can really, first, I think one of the first things is to release yourself from the national platform. So if you're serious about listening, you don't go into those conversations, whether it's with an individual or on social media or whatever forum, with your mind already made up. Mm. So if you go to South Dakota and I'm just throwing us a hypothetical. If you're a far left candidate and you go to South Dakota and you listen successfully, you might discover that people want something different than what you already believe. And so if you're truly listening, as Mike is describing, then I think first thing you need to do is release yourself from the party platform. And don't run as necessarily a Democrat who is going to go and as soon as you're sworn in, hand over your vote to the minority or majority leader.
Yeah.
Make your own decisions and listen to what people. If you're a representative in the U.S. House, you are a representative. I mean, that's what that is. Governor is a different story where you're asked to be a leader of this.
Executive, yeah.
So I think to truly listen, and I think it's a great role model for future candidates. You know, what if you had someone who did this really successfully and still lost? Maybe there's something that other candidates in the future could learn from and said, hey, that worked pretty good. Maybe it didn't work, but boy, you did a lot better than I thought, or listened to a lot of people, or maybe the winning candidate is going to adopt some of the things that were brought up by the losing candidate because it was a successful path.
Yeah. You know, in 2000, I believe it was two, John Locke, the late John Miller, and Ed Hogan wrote a piece looking at when do Democrats have success in South Dakota elections. And one of them was, the primary one was, when the ag sector is suffering. Mm-hmm. There were a number of other things that they had to say, but I think that is what would give a Democratic candidate hope, is as we begin to see the effects of tariffs on small businesses, even though the Kelly Lefflers of the world say that the data don't show that, the data do show that, mm-hmm. that tariffs are paid for by whoever buys the item. And in order to keep some level of market share, the merchant may eat some of the cost, so to speak. But I think it's not a loss, but it is the case that the Democratic brand is rather toxic. But that's the national Democratic brand. You know, I've lived in a couple other states, and almost all South Dakotans are conservative to an extent. Mm-hmm. We tend not to like a lot of change, unless we see that there's a big change needed.
Also, a lovely event that maybe goes underreported sometimes, but there was a naturalization ceremony at Mount Rushmore not too long ago, and lots of people stood up and said, I would like to be an American, and were given, they're granted that, they're naturalized, they're United States citizens. John, what do you take from these events?
Well, they're thrilling to me, and if you attend one, and I have not, but I've seen film on television, something that mm-hmm. the people who are granted citizenship are thrilled. And they've made a commitment to going through a process, which I think part of the reason I think immigration is such a tough thing in America is because policy is one thing and practice is another. And most people say, I don't get it. What's the law and what's not the law? And so if you have a path and it's successful, there's a lot of people that argue this path should be wider, right? You should allow more legal possibilities. But if you get to these immigration ceremonies, they're very exciting. We should all attend. Frankly, we should all attend one every 10 years and raise our own hand, right, and say, I pledge to be a good citizen. I think it's a great reinforcement. It's probably like saying Pledge of Allegiance when you're a child is like.
When I covered one of these in Pierre recently, one of the things that I sat down for interviews with people who wanted to talk was just how hard it was as well, that how long it took, how scared they were, that something that they would get, you know, that they would somehow get caught up in something that would cause them to be deported, how important it was to them. But there was a real sense of relief as well as joy that they had been able to go through all these steps. And I asked again and again, what would make it easier? What do you think? And they were just like, it was so hard to figure out. Was again and again, what I heard was there were not enough people to answer my questions. The legal framework was so complicated that it just took so much of our time. It was really hard. Please make it more understandable.
You know, a couple of years ago, I was on with John Schaff, and he spoke about how many of the students that we received in South Dakota's colleges and universities wouldn't do well on the naturalization test. Because in addition to all the
questions,
hoops, you're going to be asked 10, not multiple guess, 10 questions that you're going to have to provide an answer out of 100 possible questions. And as, you know, as we look at this, it's a pretty good civics test.
Yeah.
And I would hope that our South Dakota residents would do as well on the test as our new immigrants do. It may be a stretch to say that they probably know more about how our government really works, at least how it's structured, than most of our population mm-hmm. does, because we don't think about it.
Yeah.
And now with social media, we are listening to what somebody else tells us is the truth, as opposed to saying, what exactly does this original document say?
Mm-hmm. Maybe Lori should administer the test to you and me, Mike.
Do you have it in front of you?
I just happened to have brought
eight questions out of 100.
All right. 100. Oh, okay. I got to.
You need a magnifying glass.
I'm going to go ahead and switch my reading glasses. This will be on the podcast version of the show.
Okay.
She's going to ask us the hard ones.
I got to find a hard question here.
I knew she was going to go for a hard one.
Yeah. Okay. Some of these are pretty.
Some are pretty vanilla, but again,
important. Not, you know, they're important. I just know you all are going to know them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to make the test harder,
right? She's trying to embarrass us on air.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Not embarrass. Okay. So there's all kinds of things about how the government works here. There were 13 original states. Name three, John Hunter. Three of the original 13 states.
New York, Pennsylvania, and Delaware.
It was really fast. Yes, you're correct. New York. Yeah. Yep, there they are. I got to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Card, name one American Indian tribe in the United States.
Do you want the Lakota name?
Well, I want
just
one that's listed.
Pronounced in Lakota.
Yeah.
Well, there, you know, certainly, you know, my mother was from Oklahoma, and she talked about the Cherokee and the Chickasha, as well as in South Dakota, we're very familiar with the Cheyenne and the various sections of the Lakota people.
Very nice. One of the longest rivers in the United States, John Hunter.
Missouri, that runs through South Dakota.
Everyone here should know that. Who was the president during World War I?
Woodrow Wilson.
Who was the president during the Great Depression and World War II?
Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. One war fought by the United States in the 1900s.
Well, we certainly have World War I, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War. I mean, we can go on.
That's all of them except for one that's listed on here. I'm sure there's more, but
yes.
Persian Gulf. What territory did the United States... We should just have done them all.
We're doing okay so far.
What territory did the United States buy from France in 1803?
The Louisiana Purchase.
Very nice. What did Martin Luther King Jr. do?
Well, he protested the treatment of African Americans in the United States, as well as talk about how that ill treatment affected everyone in the United States.
His main occupation was a Baptist minister.
As a Baptist minister.
John Hunter, what stops one branch of government from becoming too powerful?
I would say the people can throw them out if they become too powerful. Except for the judicial branch,
right.
The other two branches are both elected by the people and frequently.
And they can be impeached and they can be dismissed from their chamber of Congress.
Yeah. Separation of powers and checks and balances are the right. General. Yeah,
those Fair are enough. The very mm-hmm. things that our founders wanted to keep us using to keep us from being an authoritarian power.
Yeah. Two cabinet level positions.
Department of Homeland Security.
and the Secretary of State.
There we go.
We'll go there. Secretary of the Treasury. We could go on.
Yeah. It's pretty good. I think you passed. You're citizens. Congratulations. 100 questions. Wow. The last day you can send in federal income tax forms.
Regularly is
October.
April.
Yeah, October 15th if you file for an extension. How's that?
Otherwise, it's April 15th.
which just seems like just right around the corner now. Okay. John Hunter and Mike Card, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks for having us, Lori.